The first extermination claims in Washington. The first inside events relative to the extermination propaganda were in the context of a conflict involving the U.S. State and Treasury Departments and the World Jewish Congress, and American Jewish Congress, headed by Rabbi Stephen S. Wise. The prominent characters in the story are Treasury Secretary Morgenthau, later the nominal author of the notorious Morgenthau Plan for the Despoliation of Germany, Secretary of State Cordell Hull and Undersecretary of State Sumner Wells, who were mildly reluctant to be carried along by the propaganda, and Assistant Secretary of State J. Breckinridge Long, who was very resistant to the propaganda. Also involved are the World Jewish Congress representatives in Switzerland, Gerhard Riechner, and Professor Paul Guggenheim, who transmitted stories of supposedly European origin to Wise or to other persons in the U.S., notably to the State Department through the U.S. Ambassador to Switzerland, Leland Harrison, or through the U.S. Consul in Geneva, Paul C. Squire. The principal work that has set forth the events surrounding the birth of the extermination legend is Arthur D. Morse's, While 6 Million Died, a book which is supplemented to some extent by Henry L. Feingold's, The Politics of Rescue. Additional material had been contributed by post-war accounts given by Morgenthau, historians J. M. Bloom and Anthony Kubek, in interpreting Morgenthau's papers, the latter for the U.S. Senate publication, Morgenthau Diary, historian F. L. Israel, in summarizing the papers of J. Breckinridge Long, and J. Dubois, who was at first chief counsel of the Treasury's Foreign Funds Control, involved in these matters chiefly in connection with efforts to extend assistance to refugees. The first extermination claim appears to have been made by the London section of the World Jewish Congress in June 1942. It was claimed that 1 million Jews had been killed in some undesignated and unlocated, quote, vast slaughterhouse for Jews, unquote, which had been established in Eastern Europe. The only attempt to provide evidence for this claim was a remark that the Polish government in exile in London had received confirming information. The allegation was carried in the New York Times in a story that will be reviewed below. The evidence for this London claim was obviously too flimsy to serve as effective propaganda, so an effort was made to improve matters slightly. On August 8, 1942, Riechner and Guggenheim approached the U.S. consulate in Geneva, which had been cooperating with the World Jewish Congress to the extent of allowing it to use diplomatic channels for messages, with a story that some anonymous German industrialist had informed them that he had learned of a decision to kill all non-Soviet Jews under German control. Discussions, which the industrialist had overheard, were being held in the Führer's headquarters regarding the methods to be employed. One method under discussion was gassing with prussic acid, hydrogen cyanide gas, after the Jews had been concentrated at camps in Eastern Europe. This story was forwarded to Washington by the consulate via U.S. diplomatic channels and to London via British diplomatic channels. The industrialist has remained anonymous to this day. When the U.S. State Department received the message, it was evaluated and it was decided that, quote, it does not appear advisable, in view of the fantastic nature of the allegations and the impossibility of our being of any assistance, if such action were taken, to transmit the information to Dr. Wise as suggested, unquote. The message was accordingly suppressed, but Wise learned of its contents anyway. It is said that he learned from London, but it is also possible that he had composed the message in the first place, and learned of its transmission and suppression through his various connections. Wise immediately contacted Wells, who had approved the decision to suppress, in order to protest the State Department's handling of the matter. Wells replied that the quote-unquote information was somewhat too unsubstantiated to be taken seriously, and that some confirmation should be obtained before any public announcement was made. Wells then instructed the U.S. representative in the Vatican to attempt to check the allegations with Vatican sources. At that time, almost nobody in Washington pretended to take these claims seriously, and even President Roosevelt assured Justice Felix Frankfurter that the Jews who had been deported to the East were merely being used to help build fortifications. In September 1942, two anonymous persons showed up in Geneva claiming to have escaped from German-controlled areas. They reported the extermination of Polish Jews, and the utilization of the Jewish corpses for the manufacture of fertilizer. This was forwarded to Washington through diplomatic channels, and again an attempt was made to get confirmation by the Vatican, which had thus far ignored the first request for confirmation. At about the same time, Wise had received a message from a World Jewish Congress official in Europe reporting on the, quote, manufacture of soap and artificial fertilizer, unquote, from Jewish corpses. In late September 1942, Riechner came forward with two new documents. The first had, he said, been prepared by an, naturally anonymous officer attached to the German High Command, and had reached Riechner through several intermediaries. The anonymous officer claimed that there were at least two factories in existence which were manufacturing soap, glue, and lubricants from Jewish corpses, and that it had been determined that each Jewish corpse was worth 50 Reichsmarks. The second document consisted of two coded letters that had, it was said, been written by a Swiss Jew resident in Warsaw. The anonymous Jew reported wholesale exterminations of Warsaw Jews deported to the East. All of these messages were forwarded to Washington and then filed. In passing, we should note the resemblance of such claims to World War I propaganda, and the appalling lack of originality and creativity on the part of the World Jewish Congress. It scarcely requires remarking that the soap and glue factories were a very transient propaganda phenomenon, and that the only similar charges made at Nuremberg were made by the Russians. These charges were largely ignored even then, and nobody, to my knowledge, has since come forward with the locations of these factories, the identities of the persons who managed them, or similar information. Reitlinger does not claim the existence of such factories, and Hilberg, page 624, does not believe they existed. On October 10, the Vatican finally informed the U.S. representatives that it had been unable to confirm the many reports it had heard of severe measures against the Jews. On October 22, Reitlinger met with Ambassador Harrison, and presented him with more of the same sort of quote-unquote evidence, this time reporting quote-unquote information provided by yet another anonymous German informant, whose name, however, is said to have been presented to Harrison in a sealed envelope, and to have been kept secret from everybody but the Office of Strategic Services, OSS, and also an anonymous official of the International Red Cross. Harrison forwarded this material to Washington, but also wrote two personal letters to Wells in late October, claiming that he knew the name of the German industrialist, and also claiming that the anonymous Red Cross official was Carl Jacob Burckhardt, the distinguished Voltaire Gouda scholar who was prominent in the International Red Cross during the war. He enclosed an affidavit that Guggenheim had deposed before Squire on October 29, in which Guggenheim claimed that he had obtained from an anonymous German informant information confirming Reitlinger's claims. The anonymous German informant had gotten his information from an anonymous official of the German Foreign Ministry and from an anonymous official of the German Ministry of War. Moreover, an anonymous Swiss informant, resident in Belgrade, had also given information to Guggenheim supporting the claims. In order to confirm the claims, Squire arranged an interview with Burckhardt, which took place in Geneva on November 7. On November 9, Squire communicated to Harrison his memorandum on the interview, in which he had recorded that Burckhardt's information was that Hitler had signed an order that, before the end of 1942, Germany must be free of all Jews. Squire's account of the interview explains, quote, "I then asked him whether the word extermination, or its equivalent, was employed, to which he replied that the words must be Judenfrei, free of Jews, were utilized. He then made it clear that since there is no place to send these Jews, and since the territory must be cleared of this race, it is obvious what the net result would be," unquote. This, the report of an ambiguous remark, made by an imperfectly informed Swiss citizen, reported by an intermediary who was friendly to the World Jewish Congress, and eager to discover a sinister interpretation to such facts as were available, is as solid as this quote-unquote evidence ever got. To my knowledge, Burckhardt never spoke out publicly, during or after the war, in connection with these matters. He answered some written questions, which were put to him by Kaltenbrunner's defense during the IMT trial, but these questions relating to Kaltenbrunner's efforts to permit the Red Cross to enter the German camps toward the end of the war were not relevant to our subject. Nobody asked Burckhardt about exterminations. Late in November 1942, the State Department received quote-unquote information from an anonymous Vatican source consisting of a three-page description, in French, of events allegedly transpiring in Poland. The document is unsigned, and the only sort of endorsement is a handwritten notation, quote, "from Mr. F. at Vatican City," unquote, which appears in an unknown hand on the first page. The document reports, inter alia, quote, "farms for the breeding of human beings are being organized, to which women and girls are brought for the purpose of being made mothers of children, who are then taken from them to be raised in Nazi establishments. Mass execution of Jews continues. They are killed by poison gas in chambers especially prepared for that purpose, often in railway cars, and by machine gun fire, following which the dead and the dying are both covered with earth. Reports are being circulated to the effect that the Germans are making use of their corpses in plants manufacturing chemical products, soap-making factories," unquote. During the late summer and autumn of 1942, Wise had continuously campaigned for the Allied governments to take a public position, directly condemning the alleged exterminations of Jews in Europe. On December 8, 1942, Wise led a delegation to the White House, and presented to President Roosevelt a 20-page document entitled Blueprint for Extermination, which was based on the sort of quote-unquote information we have reviewed. Related Jewish pressures finally brought capitulation to Wise on the mythical exterminations, and on December 17, 1942, the Allies, led by Washington, issued a statement condemning the exterminations. A related statement, released 2 days later, claimed exterminations at Belzec and at Helmnow, but Auschwitz was not mentioned. The relevant news stories are reviewed below. Despite this public declaration, the group headed by Jay Breckinridge long continued to resist the propaganda. On January 19, 1943, Reichner gave Harrison the quote-unquote information that, quote, in one place in Poland, 6,000 Jews are killed daily, unquote. On January 21, Harrison communicated this material to the State Department, and also to certain unspecified, quote, private Jewish agencies, unquote, apparently meaning WISE. The message was merely filed, and the department made no public mention of it. For a time, the private Jewish agencies were also silent about the message. On February 10, Long's group took a further step in suppression of such propaganda. In a message signed by Wells, who is said to have not read the message, and with particular reference to Harrison's cable of January 21, it instructed Harrison, quote, in the future, reports submitted to you for transmission to private persons in the United States should not be accepted, unless extraordinary circumstances make such action advisable. It is felt that by sending such private messages which circumvent neutral countries' censorship, we risk the possibility that neutral countries might find it necessary to take steps to curtail or abolish our official secret means of communication, unquote. Finally, on February 14, the New York Times published the story, see below. For explanation of the delay of 4 weeks in publishing the story, despite its being received by private Jewish agencies on January 21, and despite the evident policy of publishing the unsupported claims of such agencies, we can only conjecture that certain unknown persons were hoping that the State Department, given the precedent of the Declaration of December 17, would release the quote-unquote information so as to confer a greater credibility than would have been granted to the story as it eventually appeared, a claim indistinguishable in terms of authority from the average sort of atrocity claim. The Treasury, which, because of Morgenthau's long crusade against Germany, had repeatedly interfered in the conduct of foreign affairs since at least 1936, was soon to come into conflict with state over this suppression. A second and more substantial basis for conflict between the two departments was also established in February 1943. It was learned that the Romanian government was prepared to transfer 70,000 Jews to Palestine on Romanian ships bearing Vatican insignia. It is unlikely that the Romanians really cared where the Jews were sent, so I assume that the Palestine destination must have been somehow specified by the Zionists involved in the formulation of the proposals. An important condition was specified by, quote, officials who were in charge in Romania of Jewish interests, unquote. A cost of £250, about $1,200 per capita was specified. There were other difficulties. The British policy at the time was not to antagonize the Arabs, especially in view of the potentially catastrophic consequences of an Arab uprising in wartime, and thus the British at first refused to consider the admission of so many Jews to Palestine. The British took the position that, if such Jews were to be taken out of Europe, the US should provide camps in North Africa for them. In addition, both the British Foreign Office and the US State Department took the position that there would inevitably be spies in such a large group of people, that the logistical problems involved in transporting and accommodating such numbers were formidable, and that the money demanded might fall into the hands of the enemy, who valued Allied currency for various purposes. The Treasury was eager to get into the business of aiding Jewish refugees, and thus, it sought to overcome such objections. By July 1943, there was said to be bribe money demanded for the Romanian Jews, $170,000, and the Treasury and the World Jewish Congress proposed that Romanian Jewish businessmen could produce the bribe money, if they could be reimbursed after the war with money to be held in escrow in Switzerland. However, the British objections to admitting Jews to Palestine stood, and efforts to circumvent them by proposing other destinations for the Jews ran into the opposition of various candidate countries and also into US immigration laws. The State Department, especially J. Breckinridge Long and Associates, considered all the talk about exterminations to be just wartime propaganda in the same spirit as the stories invented during World War I. They were, after all, continually considering proposals to move these exterminated people out of Europe. As late as January 1944, the department was taking steps to encourage Jews to leave Poland for Hungary. Long wrote that one danger in supporting the proposals of WISE was that it, quote, may lend color to the charges of Hitler that we are fighting this war on account of, and at the instigation and direction of our Jewish citizens, unquote. State considered the whole project pointless and, indeed, in conflict with the requirements of an optimum war effort. Long wrote that, quote, WISE always assumes such a sanctimonious air, and pleads for the intellectuals and brave spirits, refugees from the tortures of the dictators or words to that effect. Of course only an infinitesimal fraction of the immigrants are of that category, and some are certainly German agents. I did not allude to the Navmer, en route from Lisbon to Havana and New York, a freight boat, passenger accommodations for 15, and 1,200 poor Jews above and below decks with no sanitary arrangements, no service, no kitchen facilities, at from $700 to $1,500 apiece, 4 dead before reaching Bermuda, 6 hospitalized there, one of which died, victims of the greed of their fellows, not of Germany or the United States policy. The vessel is a menace to the health of any port where it stops, and a shame to the human greed which makes it possible. But I did not allude to it in reply to Rabbi Wise. Each one of these men hates me. I am to them the embodiment of a nemesis. They each and all believe every person, everywhere, has a right to come to the United States. I believe nobody, anywhere, has a right to enter the United States unless the United States desires, unquote. The State Department either procrastinated on the matter or actively sabotaged the proposed project. At the end of the summer of 1943, it was learned that 6,000 Jewish children could be taken out of France, and this possibility got involved in the problem. The people from the Treasury and the World Jewish Congress kept pressing for the proposed projects, and continually asserted, with apparent complete seriousness, that the only alternative was the death of the people in question at the hands of Hitler. It was even openly charged that the failure to approve the projects was, quote, acquiescence of this government in the murder of the Jews, unquote. Pressure was also put on the British by various people. Long had become a whipping boy both publicly and within government circles, and he wrote bitterly that, quote, the Jewish agitation depends on attacking some individual. Otherwise they would have no publicity. So for the time being I am the bullseye, unquote. As a result of this campaign, Wise and Morgenthau achieved a breakthrough in December 1943, when arrangements were finally made for the evacuation of Romanian Jews, and money was put into a Swiss account controlled by Riechner and the U.S. Treasury. Moreover, in December 1943, Romania put out peace feelers, and was assured it would be treated well. If it treated its Jews well, Romania immediately decided to repatriate Jews it had resettled by the Sea of Azov in Russia. This Morgenthau victory had been achieved at a December 20 meeting of Hull, Long, Morgenthau, and John Pelle, chief of the Treasury's Foreign Funds Control. Morgenthau had evidently decided on a showdown with state over the entire matter, for at that meeting he casually requested a copy of the complete text of the February 10 message from Wells to Harrison, the suppression instruction. The State Department complied, but deleted the reference to Harrison's message of January 21, thereby causing the message of February 10 to appear utterly routine. In thus editing the message, State was obviously unaware that the complete contents of this correspondence had already been leaked to Dubois and the Treasury by Donald Hiss of the State Department, brother of Alger Hiss and later identified in Bentley Chambers' testimony as a communist, although he denied it, who had acquired copies of the messages only with great difficulty and, in complying with Dubois' request, nevertheless cautioned the latter that the messages were, quote, none of Treasury's business, unquote, and that Hiss could lose his job for the leak. When Morgenthau received the edited message, he knew that he had another weapon to use against Long and Associates, and thus, he brought on a collision by charging editing of the message, and demanding to see the unedited files, which were produced shortly later, exposing State's clumsy attempt at concealment. The State Department people were now very much on the defensive, and further examination of the State Department files, which the Treasury was now in a position to insist on, revealed that, in response to a request by Wise, Wells had cabled Harrison in April to meet with Riechner, and transmit new information that Riechner was supposed to have obtained. The confused Harrison did as requested. Riechner's information had to do with proposals to assist Jewish refugees in France and Romania, and also remarked to Wells that such material should not be subjected to the restriction imposed by the February 10 message. Morgenthau was victorious in the State Treasury collision. Roosevelt, drawn into the issue, sided with him by establishing in January 1944 the so-called War Refugee Board, consisting of Morgenthau, Hull, and Secretary of War Stimson. However, the executive director was, quote, Morgenthau's fair-haired boy, unquote, John Pelle, and Josiah Dubois was the general counsel. It was thus Morgenthau's board. The WRB naturally acquired the powers that had been held by the three government departments that were involved in the proposed projects for taking Jews out of Europe. Thus, the State Department became committed to appointing special attachés with diplomatic status on the recommendation of the board. The UNRWA, United Nations Relief and Rehabilitation Administration, set up the previous November, was to have a similar function but only after the war ended. In order to completely grasp the nature of its development and its import in terms of our subject, we should go beyond noting the obvious fact that the WRB was to serve, to a great extent, simply as an instrument of the World Jewish Congress and other Zionist organizations. The communist apparatus was also through one of the directors involved, for the person to whom Morgenthau had delegated all of the Treasury's powers in the areas relevant to the WRB was Harry Dexter White, later exposed as a Soviet agent. White became a member of Morgenthau's inner circle in the spring of 1938. A week after Pearl Harbor, Morgenthau announced that, Quote, on and after this date, Mr. Harry D. White, assistant to the Secretary, will assume full responsibility for all matters with which the Treasury Department has to deal having a bearing on foreign relations, unquote. The extreme generality of the wording of this order, especially the phrase, having a bearing on, were to create grand opportunities for White in the years ahead. In early 1943, Morgenthau amplified White's responsibilities, quote, effective this date, I would like you to take supervision over, and assume full responsibility for Treasury's participation in all economic and financial matters, in connection with the operations of the Army and Navy and the civilian affairs, in the foreign areas in which our armed forces are operating or are likely to operate. This will, of course, include general liaison with the State Department, Army, and Navy, and other departments or agencies and representatives of foreign governments on these matters, unquote. White, who became an Assistant Secretary of the Treasury in early 1945, took full advantage of these powers, especially in connection with occupation policy in Germany. It is also evident that, because the WRB was to a large degree an arm of the Treasury, its operations fell into White's domain. It is also worth remarking that the General Counsel of the WRB, Dubois, was quote-unquote closely associated with the communist agent William L. Ullman, and was also a witness of White's will. Long had mixed and, as it developed, prescient thoughts about the implications of these developments, quote, it will be only a few more days now before I relinquish jurisdiction in connection with refugees, and let somebody else have the fun. And it has been a heavy responsibility, domestic as well as foreign, because there are 5 million Jews in the country, of whom 4 million are concentrated in and around New York City. And we have no Arab or Muslim population, but we do have increasingly important commercial interests, principally oil, in the Muslim countries. In addition, our ally England has hardly any Jewish citizenship but a very large political interest in the Near East. So our policy is increasingly based in part, a large part, on a domestic situation, while England's is based entirely on a foreign affairs base, and the two are hard to reconcile. It is good news for me. This ensures me staying out. What they can do that I have not done I cannot imagine, unquote. Long miscalculated on the last point, for the WRB eventually did a considerable amount of Jew relocation, and its acts on behalf of refugees are of great importance in this book, and are discussed in Chapter 7. In the final weeks of the war, it also aided concentration camp inmates through the Red Cross. As an instrument of WISE and other Zionists, the WRB also did considerable propagandizing, and its most consequential propaganda achievement was a booklet, German Extermination Camps, Auschwitz and Birkenau, Executive Office of the President Washington, November 1944. The booklet is hereafter referred to as the WRB Report. The WRB report constituted the formal birth of the quote-unquote official thesis of exterminations via gas chamber at Auschwitz. In it, all of the essentials and many of the details of the later Auschwitz hoax are found. The Nuremberg charges grew out of the WRB report. There does not seem to have been any particularly strong reaction, one way or the other, to the WRB report, at the time that it was issued. However, an American journalist, Oswald F. Skoot, wrote a critical letter to Stimson, one of the signers of the report, but Skoot did not get a satisfactory reply. Of course, the WRB report failed to change the opinions of the State Department people, who had scoffed at the extermination propaganda from the very beginning. In private with Dubois, they were blunt in their opinion of the WRB report, quote, stuff like this has been coming from Bern ever since 1942. Don't forget, this is a Jew telling about the Jews. This is just a campaign by that Jew Morgenthau and his Jewish assistants, unquote. The WRB report was said to have been transmitted from Bern to Washington. The report will be discussed in depth, after we have surveyed a key part of the wartime propaganda in its public aspect. First, however, we should point out that some otherwise keen observers misinterpret the role of Auschwitz in the extermination legend. The distinguished American journalist and historian Harry Elmer Barnes wrote in 1967 that the extermination, quote, camps were first presented as those in Germany, such as Dachau, Belsen, Buchenwald, Sachsenhausen, and Dora, but it was demonstrated that there had been no systematic extermination in those camps. Attention was then moved on to Auschwitz, Treblinka, Belzec, Chełmno, Jonoska, Tarno, Ravensbrück, Mauthausen, Brasenia, and Birkenau, which does not exhaust the list, that appears to have been extended as needed, unquote. The basis for Barnes's misunderstanding, of course, is that at the end of the war the mass media, for the sake of sensation mongering, did indeed seize on the scenes found in the German camps as proof of exterminations, and it is also true, as we indicated in the previous chapter, that these scenes have served as the mass propaganda quote-unquote proof of exterminations. However, our analysis shows that Auschwitz had been carefully chosen in 1944 as the core for the extermination hoax. This point will be supported by material to be reviewed below and also in chapters 4 and 5. By publishing the WRB report in November 1944, Washington committed itself to a specific form of the hoax. That form was maintained in the trials in Nuremberg, and even today, the form of the hoax does not differ in any significant respect from the WRB report. After his WRB victory, Morgenthau busied himself with other things, particularly with the policies to be followed in occupied Germany. He found that existing plans actually paid regard to the Hague and Geneva Conventions, to which the United States was signatory, and which prohibited such things as the seizure of private personal property of no military significance, the detaining of POWs long after the end of hostilities, and the needless imposition of starvation rations. He therefore campaigned for the harsher policies, which later became known as the Morgenthau Plan, and of which many were actually adopted and put into practice. David Marcus and the CAD sponsored Morgenthau's objectives there, and kept him informed about his opponents. Colonel Bernard Bernstein, long associated with Morgenthau, performed a similar function for him at Supreme Headquarters Allied Expeditionary Forces, SHAEF, in London. Baruch also helped out.